Night Corner, dear. Happy Christmas from the Village Oak Tree. I'm your host, Terrence O'Donnell, and this is my Christmas show, even though I don't typically celebrate Christian holidays. Now, as I said last week, this week's podcast is primarily going to be about this latest Trump tactic of taxing, tariffing the hell out of Canada and Mexico and maybe a couple others. Canada is running scared as a 25% tariff on all imports from Canada to the U.S. would cripple the Canadian economy. I have several news stories from the Canadian CBC News, along with a blog article from a young Canadian friend of mine who graciously wrote the article when I asked her for a contribution on this subject. I also have some other news stories to talk about that may also have an effect on everyone's lives after the holidays are over. So stay tuned as we dig into the stories I found for you. After my commercial break, I found an inspirational Christmas story, maybe Irish, sounds Irish, and I'm going to read it to you as my gift to all of you who watch this video. I would ask that you give your appreciation to the author if you do chance to read along with me. So come sit you down by the Cronulla, the Christmas tree, and listen to me tell you some tales about the world outside. So let's start off with all his business with Canada. So I realized that this year, the major Christian holiday Christmas is also celebrated today. But as I'm not a Christian, nor do I celebrate this holiday much, other than relaxing with family and cooking a special dinner, I'm in keeping with my schedule of publishing this podcast every Wednesday. It just so happens Christmas comes on a Wednesday. Most Americans and Europeans probably won't watch or listen to this until after their festivities are over, and that's okay. The problems I'm going to talk about this week are not going to go away just because it's the Christian end of the Roman calendar year. I follow two calendars, the Celtic one and the Western calendar, only because they make me. The first problem is, of course, this business of Trump threatening his neighboring sovereign nations with a 25% tariff across the board on all trade goods imported from Canada and Mexico, 100% if you're from China. If these two countries don't severely step up their border security with regard to the smuggling of fentanyl and other drugs, human trafficking, illegal migrant smuggling mostly, and stopping the flow of illegal immigrants from across the United States borders, Trump's going to slam them with these tariffs. Mexico's new El Presidente has told Trump that she's willing to work with the United States on the issue, but if Trump thinks he can bully Mexico, she'll take her trade business elsewhere. With all the new trade deals Mexico is making with China and other Latin American countries these days, they don't need the U.S. as badly as the Canadians do. She's basically told Trump we can either work together or not, but we'll not be intimidated. I haven't heard much about this from Mexico since. In another article I found on the CBC, turns out that Mexico has given into the U.S. on a lot more things than the Canadians, and they are asking themselves how much our sovereignty are we willing to give up to Trump with this business of tariffs and other security issues. Are Canadians willing to cede more like Mexico has in order to pacify Trump? According to the CBC, Mexico has been bullied into letting the USDEA agency set up all over the country in order to help combat drug smuggling, the cartels, and other so-called national security issues. So if anybody remembers anything here earlier this year, the Republican MAGA group wanted to invade Mexico, the northern part anyway, to take out some cartels after that couple in Texas was killed. Of course, the cartels took care of that problem for them, so all that died down. But that doesn't mean it hasn't been simmering in the background. Which is where the problem with lies in Canada. Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has already made one trip to try and kiss the Donald ring to no avail. All that did was make the bullying even worse, with Trump using his Truth Social media account to slander Canada as America's 51st straight. He also called Mexico the 52nd, told Mexico figuratively flipped him the bird. This has massively upset a lot of Canadians in many ways. My oldest article from the CBC, by all I mean a week or so, describes how the Premier of Ontario, Doug Ford, wants to retaliate to the tariffs by shutting off the electricity to Americans who live near the southern Canadian border. States like Michigan, New York, Minnesota would probably be the hardest hit. But even farther east, Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont could be hit hard if Quebec were to do the same thing. So Trump responded back when queried that he doesn't care about that. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of American households across the northern U.S. border could lose their electricity for a bit until the United States figures out how to replace the losses. And it would be, and of course, Trump being the way he is, he'd leave it up to the states to figure it out. Just goes to show you how much disdain this filthy rich soon-to-be president of the United States has for the people of the country he's getting ready to govern. I will admit now that Ontario and Canada as a whole would only shut off the electricity as a last resort. But the threat is there and real. That's not the only thing they have that they can deny the U.S. if pushed. Other Canadian provinces export other things like oil, rare metals, and other materials that U.S. manufacturing needs to keep their companies going. What little bit of manufacturing the U.S. has left anyway. Without that, the U.S. would suffer some serious economic hardships as well. Now, imagine some of these corporate CEOs probably wouldn't like that too much. So it's in Trump's best interest to maintain a good working relationship with Canada, if he knows what's good for his country. That's the question being asked in a lot of places around the world these days. Does Donald Trump know what is good for the United States and its people? Or is all this bullying just a way for him to continue stroking his ego? Most sane people remember how incompetent he was during his last presidency. It's doubtful if he has changed in any way other than becoming smarter about how to get what he wants without being impeached again. I'm sure that there are a lot of lessons learned from those 4 years that won't be repeated again. Some of that we're seeing already, since he's been, voted in with some of the people he's wanted in his cabinet. With what we're watching so far in the lead up to the inauguration in January, not all lessons have been learned. He's still trying his best to intimidate anyone who gets in his way. Canada is suffering a split personality over all this right now. As I mentioned, the provincial premiers have gotten together with the prime minister to try and figure out how to counter the possible tariffs. Trudeau is running around like a chicken with his head cut off, while the premiers are formulating their own plans to thwart the threat. Alberta's premier, who's had many political battles with Trudeau's government in the last couple of years, is taking a different tack with Trump's threat. Premier Daniel Smith is creating an enhanced border patrol with extra personnel and surveillance equipment to try and appease Trump and avoid the tariffs. The trouble with that is Alberta only manages about 3.3% of the overall Canada-U.S. border. So this would only help Alberta and not Greater Canada as a whole. So Ms. Danielle Smith is basically thumbing her nose at Ottawa once again. In order for this to work effectively, all the rest of the provinces at the border, on the border of the U.S. would have to follow along. The trouble is, and this is what all the rest of the premiers are asking, who's going to pay for all this enhanced border patrolling and enhanced security? Canada has a $64 billion trade deficit with the U.S. right now. Considering what the U.S. owes everyone else in the world, this isn't very much in the overall scheme of things. Canada doesn't want to make this any worse, though. If anything, they want that figure to go down by a lot. Trump is telling the Canadians that he's tired of subsidizing them, which is not true, but it stings nonetheless to the Canadians everywhere. With more and more provincial premiers starting to get the message, the Canadian federal government is looking into securing the whole border rather than leaving it to the individual provinces to avoid a hodgepodge of different border security methods that would not go over well with Trump and his bully boys. And into all this mix, it's a real possibility that Prime Minister Trudeau, who is hugely unpopular these days, may be on his way out. Like his buddy Emmanuel Macron across the pond, he's made a lot of unpopular decisions about immigration and his business with trying to bend the knee to Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago. At least that's what it looked like to everyone anyway. And that even some of his most loyal followers are now starting to kind of step away. For most Canadians and people in general everywhere, It's all about the economy, stupid. Canada's economy has taken a dive under his watch. The right-wingers are taking full advantage of that in the Canadian press. There are a lot more calls now for Trudeau to step aside before his term is up. It's pretty much a given that he would not be reelected again in the next national elections. But who it takes place, especially if he did give away early. The Canadian Conservative leader, Paul Vieira, who has been a very vocal opponent of Trudeau's Liberal government over the last few years, is calling Trudeau's government a clown show and making Canada seem weak. He's all for spending Canadian tax dollars to help secure the southern border in order to avoid the tariffs. The question being asked, which bears repeating, who's going to pay for all that? Obviously, the Canadian taxpayers. So now it becomes a question of which is the greater economic threat, the tariffs or the extra billions spent on enhancing border security. It's looking like enhanced border security will probably be the winner. Paul Vieira does indeed become the next Canadian prime minister soon, as he thinks he will. Will he puff out his chest and stand up to Trump's government? Or is this current posturing in the press all a gimmick to help his image with the voters? With provincial premiers like Doug Ford and Danielle Smith behind him, and others, I'm sure, are they prepared for what Trump may do in retaliation? Maybe. In another news story, and again, I'm getting all these from CBC Canada, Canada is imposing across-the-board tariffs on all goods coming from China, starting in early 2025, with more coming for 2026. This is supposedly a mirror image of what the Americans are doing. They've been in a tiff with China for a while now, since they outed China for allegedly interfering with some elections earlier this year, and maybe even before that. They're still investigating that up there. Canadians do get mad about things, but they typically don't go off on a raging bender over things like the Americans do. Right now, the Canadians, being the polite people they are furious about how Trump is disparaging their country and threatening their economy with devastation by possibly imposing a 25% tariff on all trade goods from Canada, Alberta especially. They can't afford that on the oil they sell to the U.S. They exported 4 million barrels of oil a day to the U.S. last year for billions of dollars. No one can afford to sever that connection, neither the Canadians or the Americans. So Alberta is now waiting for Ottawa to get their act together. They're setting up their own enhanced border security program and are looking for Manitoba, Saskatchewan, British Columbia, and other provinces to come along with them. Notably, Quebec and the Atlantic Maritime provinces that have borders on the U.S. They're also reaching out to the U.S. Alberta is also reaching out to the U.S. state of Montana's governor to work directly with them rather than Trump and Trudeau. There's a lot of money at stake here for both sides. If Premier Ford should shut off the electricity, that would affect 1.5 million Americans. If Canada shuts off or imposes a major price increase on the oil being shipped to the U.S. to offset the tariffs, everyone on both sides of the border, other than the morally rich, would feel it. There will be no winners in this tariff battle, other than with a few bunch of American political egos in Washington, D.C. Maybe someone should reach out and find a way to figuratively slap these idiots, Trump being the first, to wake them all up to the economic disasters these tariffs would bring to all these countries. Not just Canada, but Mexico, the EU, and the UK, because Trump has threatened these tariffs on everybody around the world. Given just how many CEOs and minor world leaders have already made the pilgrimage to Mar-a-Lago so far, before Trump is even officially the president, to figuratively kiss his ring, I doubt anyone is going to do much to stand up to the bullies in Washington. They're all too afraid of the big bad wolf. You know, this wolf is nothing but a bunch of hot air with little substance, as we've seen from the last time he was president. To give this audience a sense of just how mad Canadians are about all of this, I will now read my friend's blog article with her permission. Her name is Sam, and she is from the Canadian Maritimes. She has her own blog website called worldweary.com, and she's also a regular contributor to medium.com. She was even a guest on this podcast earlier this year. So let me read this to you. Allies divided, Canada and the United States. And again, this is written by Sam W. And this link that I have here, which I'll put in the newsletter, is from her worldweary.com website. Once upon a time, my country had a brother. He was a loud brother, somewhat arrogant and prone to beating his chest and cranking the music volume too high. But he had our backs and we had his. The United States is a powerhouse. And owing to our shared border and long history of cooperation, our relationship has always been strong. Well, except for a few brief rocky periods in early days of nationhood, like the War of 1812 or the Lumberjack War, which in America here, in Northern Maine anyway, we call the Lumberjack War. We weren't even technically Canada yet when that happened, so do they even count? Still, a few scuffles in the distant past don't negate the strong degree of trust we've built. In many major wars, Canada stood by the United States. We're more cautious than you are, often looking to the United States to grant purpose before joining the battle, but we've never been far behind. We're especially keen to offer help when our brother nation comes under attack. When the attack on Pearl Harbor happened in 1941, Canada declared war on Japan even earlier than the United States. We stated our intention to retaliate the day it happened, a full day before the President of the United States did. Our declaration of war was approved by the King the next day, making our nation the first to act. We did our fair share of horrible things during the conflict, too. Both of our nations built concentration camps for Japanese citizens. It's a mark of shame in our country's name. Nobody messes with our brother. We've been in the war even longer than they had, owing to our membership in the Commonwealth, but we took time out of the fighting to stick up for our family. When the 9/11 terrorist attack grounded planes from the United States, those Americans who landed in Canada were greeted by the locals with open arms and doors. Every American stranded in our nation found free room and board, a warm place to sleep, and a hot meal. We value hospitality. We value freedom. We try to take care of our own. We don't always do it right, but we try. And we do consider Americans to be our own. Most Canadians know people on the other side of the border. Many businesses operate on both sides of the line, with strong trade connections between our countries, keeping a constant flow of shipping back and forth. More than $3.5 billion in goods cross our borders daily, with America being our largest trading partner and Canada being one of America's most reliable allies. The bond is not just built on business. Many of us have friends and family that cross the border too. Many people have immigrated back and forth, cementing familial ties. My partner is one of them. He has ties to Canada, not just through me, but also through marriage. His brother-in-law is Canadian by birth. Most Canadians move south for the winter, living a part of the year in America where the weather is warmer and more hospitable. In turn, many Americans vacation here in Canada to enjoy our wintry landscape and beautiful, unspoiled wilderness trails. We share quite a bit of our culture, too. We're distinct, but most Canadians watch American TV and movies, and I've never met an American who didn't love Timbits, or Tim Hortons, for that matter. I used to go to Tim Hortons a lot. They adore our inventions, too. Canadians invented everything from insulin to half the sports Americans love, the sports that dominate the playing field of popularity originated in Canada. Yes, even American football. You're welcome. Our two nations are truly siblings. Born of rebellion against a domineering parent, Canada might keep in contact with Dad back home, but even so, we still turn to our brothers first when times are tough. We hang with each other through thick and thin. Our bond has always been unbreakable, built on the bedrock of solidarity and mutual sacrifice, and again, until now. Our brother has fallen in with the wrong crowd these past 10 years. We forgave the first major rift easily enough. Arguments about money and politics are always going to happen from time to time. He made some new friends, got exposed to some new ideas, and apologized. We set to work rebuilding the closeness we had lost. Things were going great. We thought the bad years were behind us. Then the bad friends came back around again, and here we go again. Allow me to depart from the brother nation metaphor, because at this point it no longer applies. America isn't our brother anymore. The president-elect of the United States has picked battles with us before, slapping us with tariffs and demanding a renegotiation of trade agreements. We wrote it out, dealing with economic strife and waves of sickness from imported produce as the Republican president stripped regulations and safety expectations. And now, once again, he has come out swinging against our country, except this time he's ditched the golf club and showed up with a sledgehammer. 25% tariffs on all our goods? That's bad enough to shatter our friendship. Adding insults to the pile is just icing on the cake. When our prime minister, our elected leader, who runs the country of Canada, tried to explain to Trump how this tariff plan would damage our economy and ruin our friendship, he was met with extortion. Trump joked that Canada could avoid tariffs by becoming the 51st state. Maybe that first jab could be let go, but then he did it again and again, repeatedly calling our prime minister the governor of the great state of Canada, mocking our status as a sovereign nation. And then the flavor of his comments took a turn for the far less funny and far more alarming. In the message to his followers on Truth Social, Donald Trump repeated his nonsensical belief that the United States subsidizes Canada. He says this because he doesn't understand what a trade deficit is, and he views international diplomacy as a zero-sum game. He told his followers the following. No one can answer why we subsidize Canada to the tune of over $100 million a year. Makes no sense. Many Canadians want Canada to become the 51st state. They would save massively on taxes and military protection. I think it's a great idea. 51st state. And this is from President-elect Trump on Truth Social. Note the difference in tone. Where's the joke here? Who is he poking fun at? Because as the Canadian, this doesn't sound like a joke we're supposed to be laughing at. It sounds like the elected future leader of a foreign state trying to drum up support for annexation. Before I wrote this article, I had a conversation with a friend of mine who served as an American soldier. He's a veteran, and he has lived on both sides of the border. He's familiar with the backwoods near where I grew up, and we've exchanged stories of adventure in the same mountain hills. He asked me about how things were going there, and he asked me if Canadians, the government, and the people are afraid. I thought about that question for a while. I read the news. I spoke to other Canadians. I looked at our government's response. And after all that, I can only come to one conclusion. No, we aren't scared. We're outraged. Canada's presenting a united front against this hostility from a foreign power. Our premiers are working in near lockstep, planning retaliatory tariffs and defensive postures. The Canadian people are similarly engaged. I've asked others how they feel, and I've listened to them vent, insulted, furious, offended, and sick of putting up with the manic behavior of a schoolyard bully. We aren't a particularly patriotic bunch when you compare us to the Americans, but when an external threat appears, we close ranks and put up our hands. And I feel the same way. Decades of friendship, of mutual gain, and fostering close ties and beneficial partnerships. And this man throws it all away for a few cheap political points with his ignorant voting base? And they seem to think it's funny. They won't be laughing when we snap back. Because here's the thing. The United States is a powerhouse, but so are we, literally. We're your largest source of imported energy resources. There have already been talks between premiers about turning off the lights for millions of Americans who benefit from our energy reserves, including hydroelectric oil and natural gas. We're a manufacturing, mining, lumber, and extraction economy. You depend on us for oil, metals, and minerals. You're going to miss out on a lot of your vehicles and nuclear materials, too. There are other sources, but not nearly as friendly and accommodating as we've been in the past. Did I mention plastic? That's our export, too. Oh, and pharmaceuticals and agriculture products and equipment. We aren't a pushover, and we do have clout. A few days ago, our federal government launched a plan to build up the border in an attempt to head off Trump's tariff threat at the pass. One last attempt to appease him, cool the temperature, and keep the lines of communication open. Whether that'll work is anyone's guess, but knowing Trump, his ego won't let him take the win and sit down. He can pull all the stunts he likes. We're prepared for his next tantrum. There's a stereotype in the U.S. that labels Canadians as polite, friendly pacifists who always look to cooperate and wouldn't hurt a fly. They consistently describe us as chill and easygoing and insist that we barely have a military. They're half right. We're generally easy to get along with, as long as you treat us like family. When we're pushed into conflict, we have a different reputation. Ask wartime historians about Canada's military history. We built an army from nothing during World War I and became a force to be reckoned with within a few short years. Canada has teeth. We prefer to be friends and make peace when we can, but nobody stays quiet forever. Nobody endures hostility forever. Nobody withstands bullying, insults, and mockery forever. There are three things all wise men fear: the sea in a storm, a night with no moon, and the anger of a gentle man. And this is a quote from Patrick Rothfuss, The Wise Man's Fear. So that's her story. So just that gives you an idea of just what they really think up there. So now that you see that Canadians won't allow themselves to be bullied by the United States, let me tell you another reason why they appear to be weaker, at least in the eyes of the U.S. and NATO. They have one of the smallest militaries in NATO. Compared to the massive military that the U.S., China, and Russia have, Canada's military is minuscule in comparison. They've always contended, up until Trump was president last time, that they didn't need a large military because they had oceans and the Arctic Circle on three sides and the mighty U.S. in the south. Trump got all over them during his last term for not meeting the minimum NATO standard of spending 2% of the country's GDP on their military. And, of course, at that time, Trudeau said, all right, well, we'll gear up, but it's going to take us a few years. And their original projection was, well, by 2030, we'll be ready. Well, since then, during Biden's administration, they pushed it out to, I think, 2035. But it doesn't really matter. So, of course, Trump also got on a lot of the European countries for this as well. His threat was for the U.S. to pull out of NATO altogether, something he said he'd do last time, and leave everyone high and dry. Trump's not going to do that this time yet, but the veiled threat is there. What the U.S. is doing, not necessarily Trump this time, is to push NATO Europe to spend more on their military. This includes Canada, as they are members of NATO. The new head of NATO, Rutte from the Netherlands, is pushing for everyone to divert social services spending to military spending in order to counter an imaginary Russian invasion of Europe. I say imaginary simply because Putin has said over and over and over again he has no intentions of invading Europe, especially Western Europe. All he cares about is getting NATO out of his backyard. So in a podcast blog post by Lena Petrova this week, she talks about how Trump wants NATO to bump up their defense spending to 5% of GDP to combat the perceived Russian threat. He wants the U.S. to spend less than they are now. Now the U.S. is all in a flutter over how to find the money for this. The people in the EU are already upset over their deteriorating economic situation. So do you think they would stand for their governments to divert social services money to pay for a bigger military? I don't think so. These are the leaders who are most likely to lead NATO into starting World War III out of an imagined fear of Russia. Trump is sitting back and watching. He doesn't like war, as they're not good for profits. He will do precision strikes, like when he killed that Iranian general in Iraq back in his last term. But all-out war? Not likely. You get somebody else to do it. As far as the U.S. is concerned, they can sit back and watch. The military-industrial complex makes money either way, whether they sell directly to the U.S. government when their military goes to war or to other countries when they go to war, which is the preferred method, as we've seen in the last few years. Or at least it used to work that way. As I said last week, there's a lot of rust on that American combat military equipment now, and other countries are starting to take notice. American-made is not what it used to be, and sales are dropping off. Trump wants to fix that. He doesn't care whether stuff works or falls apart after the sale. All he cares about is getting paid up front. They just sold a whole bunch of, what would they call them? Some kind of missiles to Taiwan. And, of course, China is all upset about that. Another news from last week, I'm sure everyone's heard about the Russian general who was assassinated by the Ukrainians using an Uzbek mercenary. This mercenary will be sacrificed for the Ukrainian cause because Russia is going to probably make him disappear and never be seen again. There was a lot of speculation about why Ukraine wanted him dead now. They have had chances before this, but why now? Turns out, that he had or has evidence that Ukraine was engaged in illegal biological warfare experiments funded by the United States. There were rumors in the news a couple of years ago that Russia was trying to go after those labs over in Ukraine, but they were shut down and cleaned out before the Russians got there. Imagine with probably some American help. Now, there are stories coming out after this assassination that this General Kirillov has evidence of these illegal labs, not just in Ukraine, but in other places as well, Africa for one place. The question now being asked is whether the U.S., CIA, and maybe U.K.'s MI6 were secretly operating illegal biolabs around the world to develop bioweapons for later use someday. You know, supposedly there's a international treaty that says you can't do that. General Kirillov supposedly has evidence that the labs in Ukraine were trying to develop a genetic bioweapon that would kill only ethnic Russians. Of course, with Eastern Ukrainians being full of ethnic Russians, I think they can never quite get it off the ground. But they had to pull out of Ukraine before they could even think about it. So the question is, did they set up somewhere else? Well, there's rumors that they did. Will the assassination of the general make the story go away? For now, depends on what the Russians do with it. Do you remember in a previous podcast where I talked about how badly run down the British Navy is? I have another story about how badly the world's once greatest naval fleet has fallen. The story is about Navy destroyers, or lack thereof. Apparently, their fleet is in such bad shape, they can only deploy 2 destroyers at a time anymore. And they are plagued with mechanical problems that keep them all sidelined. This out of a fleet of 10. Imagine that, only having a fleet of 10. The British Army and Air Force are no better. Britain no longer has enough military personnel to deploy any amount of soldiers for any length of time anywhere, according to one article I read. So much for the once British Empire. From the Middle East, I have a story about the news leaders of Syria asking for help with keeping Israel from taking the lower half of what used to be the sovereign nation of Syria. They can ask, but no one's listening. And Israel is expanding its reach further and further across the southern areas of the territory every week, committing atrocities as they go. The last report I read, which is like a day or so ago, the IDF rolled in some villages south of Damascus and started shooting anyone who dared protest the incursion. One gentleman got shot in the leg for his trouble, just because he didn't like the fact that they were coming in and taking over everything. Maybe this last odd bit of news I found has something to do with it. This report out of Europe that includes the U.S. states that there is a noticeable decrease in child literacy across Europe and the United States. Developed world, in other words. Are the children across the Western world becoming less educated and unable to compete with the rest of the developed world? Maybe this has something to do with the rise of the BRICS alliance. Maybe another reason why there's so much anger amongst the voting blocs in the West. They lack the education anymore to understand what their governments are doing in their names. With democratic governments coming under siege from the conservative right everywhere, is this going to be part of the new world order in the West? Majority of the populations who can barely able to master a 6th grade level reading and writing and mathematics? There are some conspiracy theorists who are saying that this is on purpose in the U.S., maybe in Europe too after this report. My last bit of news this week is more about how the United States is doing its best to control as many countries around the world as possible. Donald Trump is texting all over his Truth Social media this week. First, Trump came out with the idea of retaking the Panama Canal away from Panama because he doesn't like the transit fees that Panama is charging American ships. Now, for anybody who doesn't know, Jimmy Carter was president, and in 1979, he gave the Panamanians back the Panama Canal, and the Americans pulled out of it. So obviously, the Panamanian president responded by telling Trump, no, you can't have the Panama Canal. So will Trump move on, or will we soon hear about American troops gearing up to deploy to Panama again? So again, another history lesson. The Americans deployed units of the Special Operations Rangers units down to Panama in 1989 to round up Manuel Noriega for drug charges. So basically, we invaded their country and, kidnapped this guy, and instead of going through extradition processes and brought him back to the United States for trial. So since, you know, since we did it once, we're going to do it again. In another text on Truth Social, Trump is revisiting the idea of purchasing Greenland from the Danes again. He says it's for national security reasons. Most likely, it's because Greenland has lots of raw minerals that the Americans would love to get their hands on, such as oil, gold, copper, uranium, and so much more, plus access to the Arctic Circle to deter China and Russia. The Danes in Greenland flatly said no last time, and they're saying no again. Will Trump threaten them somehow? For a president who says he doesn't like wars, why is he making public statements that sound like he wants to move in on sovereign countries for their resources? How will Canada respond to being nearly surrounded on three sides by the aggressive Americans? This from Ireland. Those of us who belong to the Irish diaspora around the world know all about the atrocities committed on the Irish people by the British for over 800 years of colonization. They're still there in the north, creating poverty and political chaos. Republicans come under fire by Israel for supporting the Palestinians since forever, but more so since October 2023. The latest scuffle ended with Israel closing its embassy in Dublin last week. But the two ruling parties in Ireland appear to be trying to work both sides without success. The voters are starting to catch on to the duplicity of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Ireland owes approximately 60% of its income to U.S. corporations, 960 of them by most accounts. It is this tax revenue that's keeping the Irish Treasury in the black. So you can imagine the coalition that has ruled Ireland since the Civil War 100 years ago will do whatever it takes to keep the Gulf flowing, including allowing the U.S. to use its airspace and other resources to support Israel's genocide while touting their support for the Palestinians. They're signatories on the Genocide Convention, yet they're in violation because of their support for their American benefactors. In other words, let's not rock the American money boat. We can tell the people what they want to hear while taking the Yanks' money behind everyone's back. This way, everyone wins, or at least a party membership anyway. I wonder how much money in kickbacks Mikhail Higgins or Simon Harris is receiving under the table from the Americans for letting them use Irish facilities for the Israeli genocide. What about other party leaders? How many of them are on the take? Well, you know, that's how you keep people quiet. You give them money. You know, bribery is a big thing everywhere. You know, in Afghanistan, they call it bakshish. It's part of their culture. Is it part of Irish culture now? To continue to curry favor with the Americans, the current Irish government will follow the Pied Piper wherever the Yanks go as long as the money flows into their pockets. Forget about the people who voted for them, unless they're in on the scam. As always in a capitalist world, if you want to see who's committing the evils in this world, follow the money. That trail always leads to somebody with their hand in your pocket, taking your last bit of coin while distracting you with something else. I follow an Irish political page on Facebook, and some of the things they post are in direct contrast to the government in Dublin, but more in tune with what a lot of the Irish people are saying outside of Dublin. And I also follow an Irish news channel called News Talk that also talks a lot about the dissension between the government and the people. Will there be a reckoning again soon if the new same-as-before coalition government continues to dismiss the will of the majority? Well, that's the question right now. I think it's not really being asked, right? Because this soon after the election. But I tell you what, after the holidays are over with, there's probably going to be more and more people starting to ask that question. This seems to be a new trend in Europe these days. Voters are fed up with the same old thing that's bankrupting the average EU citizen everywhere in the EU. They're demanding change. I expect Ireland will follow suit soon. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael had better start paying attention. Results of the recent election should be a warning for them if they care to pay attention. It's not so much that Sinn Féin received so many votes, but it was also all the other parties who made a showing, and a lot of them made a showing, except maybe the Green Party. The people everywhere are trying to tell their governments that things need to change for the better, and soon, or else. So now I'm going to take my break. Give a listen to my advertising, And I'll return it with another chapter. I'm going to return with that story I told you, the Christmas story I told you about. I want to take this minute to explain how you can support this podcast and to advertise my book. The podcast is free and can be found on these major mobile podcast apps, on my YouTube channel, and my Substack page at Crown of Beha, the Tree of Life at Substack.com. To help defray my cost, I'm asking for donations of any amount so everyone has an opportunity to watch or listen to this podcast anywhere in the world. I set up a donations tab at rss.com on the Village Oak Tree and on my website at www.crownofbeha.com, and I'll link to PayPal for your security. This way you can use any currency you wish from around the world, providing PayPal is available to you in your country. So now let me tell you about my book. Fugitives in the New United States, which can be found on all major online book retailers around the world, comes in hardcover, paperback, and ebook version. You don't want to wait for them to print you one. You can also buy a hardcover or paperback edition from me directly through the bookstore page of my website, and I'll ship it right out to you. This is a dystopian fiction about what the United States might look like by 2031 under a Christian theocracy. It's full of drama, action, and romance, set against a backdrop of U.S. societal collapse. The story follows a trio of resistance fighters as they navigate across Upper New England in their quest to escape from the authoritarian regime. So that's all I have here, and I appreciate any effort you can to support this endeavor that I'm doing, no matter how small it may be. Thank you very much. Welcome back. So let me read to you a Christmas story. And it was written a couple years ago, well, a long time ago, actually, December 12, 2020. And the author's name is Lee, spelled L-I. And it's entitled A Christmas Story, The True Meaning of Christmas. And he published this in Illumination. Cold winter snow was piled high right up to the windowsill of the second floor bedroom. Little Johnny kneeled on his bed in his pajamas, looking out of the square frosted panes of glass. He stared longingly up at the northern skies, bejeweled with the tipped cup of the moon and the sparkling stars, hoping beyond all his wildest dreams to capture even just a fleeting glimpse of a rotund Santa Claus on his gift-burdened sleigh. For all too brief a moment, Johnny saw what he thought might be a merry Father Christmas passing through the bars of Orion. Johnny's heart skipped a beat as he held his breath. Alas, it was nothing more than a shooting star streaking across the starry night. Johnny's tensed up muscles relaxed as he settled back down on the beautiful homemade soft patchwork eiderdown which covered his bed. Downstairs, Johnny's mom had festooned the hall and living room with glossy balloons and brightly colored Christmas decorations. She was now busy putting out a glass of sherry, two hot mince pies on a small plate near the chimney for Santa. This was a sign that the moment of Santa's arrival was imminent. Eventually, Johnny was overcome with tiredness and fell fast asleep. Soon he began to dream of all the wonderful gifts that Santa would bring. Johnny had hoped for some books, a football, and a guitar. In his dream, Johnny saw Santa stoop by the big Christmas tree, arranging what looked like far more Christmas presents than he could have ever imagined. He could hardly contain his excitement, the prospect of tearing open the myriad of gift wrap parcels. Next morning, Johnny woke up with a start and raced downstairs, shouting out as he ran, "Mom, Dad, has he been?" So excited was Johnny that he almost fell down the stairs, just managing to re-catch his step at the bottom. Disaster averted. Johnny went into the living room, barely able to hold his nerves in check. "Mom, Dad," he screamed. "Santa has been. And just look at what he's left. Wow." Halfway across the living room, Johnny stopped dead in his tracks. His father quietly came up behind him and put a loving arm around him. It was a sight to behold. It was a magical moment in time when everything in the world stopped. Everything except the sheer joy of being alive at that moment in that time with the abundance and love of his parents. "Happy Christmas, son," said Johnny's father with a depth of warmth and love that all can be found in a loving father or mother. "Dad, whispered Johnny to his father. Yes, son, answered Johnny's father. You know, I have so much here, it's amazing. I have an idea, Dad. Go on, son, tell me, what's on your mind? Johnny's father said. Well, at the end of our street, there's an orphanage with lots of children who haven't got any mom or dad like me. Do you think Santa goes to that place with presents? If he doesn't, I imagine there will be very sad, huh, Dad? Why don't we go and give those children some of my presents? You always say it's better to give than to receive. Just think, Dad, we could make those poor children so happy, and we could have a lot of fun doing it, too. You could be Santa Claus, and I could be one of your little helpers. Come on, Dad, let's do it. Let's go have some fun. Maybe I can make some new friends, too, Dad. Of course, you have to pretend to be the real Santa Claus. I'd hate for them to think that Santa doesn't exist when we have all the proof we need right in front of us, huh, Dad? I mean, where else would all these presents come from? You know, son, you're right, said Johnny's father. I'm so proud of you, son. You're such a smart kid for your age. Come on, let's do it. Let's go and spread a little of that joy and happiness we have so much here. There's more than enough for everyone. And with that, Johnny and his father got changed and gathered up a bundle of Christmas presents and put them in a sack. Just at that moment, Johnny's mother came into the room and asked what was going on. When Johnny's father finished explaining, Johnny's mother simply said, well, looks like I need to get a second round of mince pies and sherry ready for when you get back, huh? As father and son set off down the street, Johnny's father said, do you know, son, what is the best Christmas present of all? The love that you give with, and you, my boy, have got it by the sackload. Come on, let's go. At the end of the street, Johnny and his proud father walked up the path to the orphanage and knocked on the door, calling out, ho, 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 as they waited for somebody to come. A rotund middle-aged woman opened the door, and upon seeing Johnny and his father, explained, why, Santa, we thought you weren't coming. The children will be so excited and happy to see you guys. And do you know, we even have some hot mince pies and a glass of sherry ready, waiting for you, Santa. Great, Johnny's father sighed good-naturedly. Just above the din, a melee of child happiness rushing to the door. I just love mince pies and sherry. So that's my story here this week. I hope everybody has a good holiday. I want everybody to be able to enjoy themselves. And I wish everybody a Merry Christmas, as I said, even though I don't celebrate too much of that. But still, at all, it doesn't really matter. I still wish everybody to have a good time. Enjoy it for however you celebrate around the world. So with that, I will say goodbye to you and wish you all a good week ahead and a happy new year. Sláinte. Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed it and you'll return again for more news and commentary about the world we live in. Please like, subscribe, reply, and share the videos or audio podcasts, however you watch or listen. The goal here is to resist the authoritarians who want to take our freedoms away from us. I appreciate everyone around the world, no matter who you are or where you are. Together, using independent media, we can resist the authoritarian oligarchs in the West. And say goodbye this week. I wish to leave you with this Irish Christmas toast as we celebrate the holiday season. Comerum id beo eg unum sho Irish. Now, I'm sure I probably butchered that to a degree because it's been like since I was a really, really, really wee one with my Irish, and I'm trying to pick it back up again. So I'll leave off and wish you all a happy holiday and everything. Slán go fóill.